Hello, I'm Andy Burnham, and you're listening to Sparks on Radio Facts. This week, a review of a new guide for Sony ICF 2001D users, digital audio broadcasting developments in Britain, expensive tuning problems for Channel 5 television, radio with a difference. We look at wireless data links, the story of the Titanic, and a history of autocue. That's all coming up in this week's Sparks, and you can hear it every week on Radio Facts 3910 6205 and 12255 every Monday and Tuesday, our weekly programme of science, technology and media news.
We are young.
Continue with the media's obsession with pirate radio stories after all the television programmes, now a play on Radio 4. The story starts with the son of the family involved in Citizens Band radio.
I might have broken a finger.
Sit still, I'll get help.
Not a bloody car in sight now, nearly dusk.
Here, there's some tea. No, thanks.
It's my left hand or I can manage the gears.
Don't worry, be home in no time. Hello.
Mayday. Mayday. Breaker break. High flyer on 3-0. Sick horse. Skateboard in ditch. Need immediate assistance. Position just past crossroads on B3159. Do you copy?
They were rescued very quickly. The car only had a dent.
Well, that's how it starts. And then later in the play, the daughter of the family gets pregnant, the mother visits Greenham Common, and the son gets involved in running his own pirate radio station.
The Irish group Clannad's New Grange has been requested by Eileen Doherty for husband Sean. Eileen and Sean live in Holly Street with their four children and write to say the whole family listen regularly. Thank you, Doherty's, and I wish you well. This is Garth Grosvenor, disc jockey on your very own local community radio station, about to sign off until this evening. Playing me out, Clannad's New Grange for the Doherty family.
Joe? Joe?
Come on in.
Can they hear us?
No, it's okay. The mic's not live at the moment.
Oh. It's all very impressive.
The real thing.
Joe, I've had a letter summoning us back to the Jubilee Hospital.
Get a lot of record requests from there.
Dear Mr. and Mrs. Lloyd, subject Joseph Lloyd. We would like to point out that when a course of family therapy is started, it is to everyone's advantage it should be continued. Our initial session in the psychiatric department of this hospital, as well as taking up the valuable time and efforts of Dr. Kleinman and myself, simply served to exemplify your difficulties without actually getting the situation
in hand. I was going
to
apply to the psychiatrist, saying we'd got the situation in hand.
Right.
Unless you thought you needed to go back.
No, I haven't got the time, have I? Shop during the day, evening radio. Sorry, Mum. I must just sign off. Garth Grosvenor saying, see you later.
Almost embarrassingly bad, isn't it? Anyway, I think the message is that the son, mixed up son's psychological problems are sorted out by the fulfillment he finds in running a pirate radio station, and he grows up to live happily ever after. That was a play called Sunshine on Radio 4.
We've had a couple of little booklets through the post. The first is called Get the Best from Your Sony ICF-2001D. So if you're listening on one of them, prick your ears up. Well, despite the clear virtues of the 2001D, it was like most successful products designed to a price and a market. This means that it doesn't quite achieve engineering perfection, and it still possesses a few rough edges that can be polished off with a little care and attention, writes Steve Witt in the first book. It's the aim of this booklet to highlight these shortcomings of the 2001D, and to suggest practical improvements that could transform a good radio into an outstanding unit. Some of these improvements take the form of internal modifications, and the others are simple outboard accessories that will enhance your listening pleasure. So what are some of these improvements? Well, there's one about the batteries. There's one about changing the filter bandwidths to make them more suitable, which seems quite useful. One about how to override the restricted tuning range that the receivers sold to certain countries are preset to. So if your ICF-2001D doesn't go all the way from 150 kHz up to 29999 kHz, then there's a little mod you can do inside to restore it back to its former glory. There's also stuff about reducing receiver overload and about improving the IF mixing. You can get reciprocal mixing, and it shows a before and after spectrum analysis, and three carefully placed capacitors can get rid of quite a lot of intermod products caused by not having a perfectly clean phase-locked loop output oscillator. There's also stuff about adjusting the sensitivity of the S-meter, selectivity of the VHF-FM,
and something about boosting the tape audio output, all which could be useful to you. There's hints and tips about choice of batteries and about using the receiver with a whip aerial, about aerial socket, and about what happens if your radio is static damaged, what components are likely to blow up if you zap it with static from the aerial or from lightning. So that's the first booklet, which is 28 pages long, and also gives some generally useful advice about buying communications receivers. And Steve Witz then produced a follow-up booklet, which isn't as big, it's only 8 pages. It's called Get Even More from Your Sony ICF-2001D. I should point out at this point that it's not applicable to ICF-2001s. It's the ICF-2001D, which is also the ICF-2010 in the United States. A few more hints and tips in this booklet. Probably the most useful bit of it is a little circuit you can build, which senses the extra current that the radio takes when it switches itself on, and uses that to turn on a cassette recorder via the remote control relay. That could be useful to you, whatever radio. That's not specific to a 2001D. It's got a couple of transistors and it's quite a clever and neat little circuit. There's also things about how to get binaural reception to put the lower sideband on the left-hand output and the upper sideband on the right-hand output. As Trevor's synchronicity modulator does, it tells you whereabouts on the circuit board to pick up to do that on your stereo. So that's two booklets. Get the best from your Sony ICF-2001D and get even more from your Sony ICF-2001D. Both published by Steve Witt, Hunt's Cottage, Kiln Lane, Bucks Hall in Suffolk, IP14 3DU in England. And he's offering a special offer to RadioFax listeners. £5 for the pair, and I think there's enough useful tips in both the books to make them worth that sort of money if you're using an ICF-2001D. However, Steve Witt also recommends that you get hold of a copy of the service manual if you're going to do some of these mods, so that's on your own head, I suppose, if you do it just from the books. There's not really any diagrams or anything, it just says the component numbers. You have to really pretty much know what you're doing. So that's £5 to Steve Witt, who's at Hunt's Cottage, Kiln Lane, Bucks Hall, that's B-U-X Hall, Suffolk, IP14 3DU in England. A couple of little books about the ICF-2001D. On to a letter now. It's from, let's see, Abdul Hamid in Glasgow. I do enjoy very much the way you put out the various information. He's listening on a Sony ICF-7600DS, also Transoceanic Zenit H-band radio, mostly listening on 6205. Keep up the good work. Well, thanks for listening, Abdul, up there in Glasgow. And here's Albert Mulder writing from Raynham in Essex. In Sparks was an interesting review of a book about Atlantis and Radio Rally at Birmingham on Easter Sunday, and also stuff about mind probe chips. Yes, indeed. Now, one more letter, I think. Ian McRae from Monarchy, Angus in Scotland, who's listening on 3910. Sparks, the interesting bit. I like the article about Atlantis, someone else. This is the first pirate radio station I've heard. Sorry, free radio station. If this is free radio, more please. Sparks was really interesting. I'll be sending off for the FRQ magazine. I was using a Sangyan ATS-803 receiver with a 6-metre wire. At the time, I was on my ship, the Grampian Sabre, an oil rig standby ship. Shortwave radio is a great boon while bobbing around on an oil rig for a month. I should think so.
Bidders for Channel 5 face costly drawback in The Independent. Broadcasters have been formally invited to put in bids to operate Britain's fifth television channel, a project fraught with pitfalls and complications. The channel will cover less than three-quarters of the country, excluding some of the wealthiest areas of southern England, and whoever wins will have to pay up to £200 million to retune about 3 million video recorders, many in households that will not necessarily be receiving the service. David Glencross, Chief Executive of the Independent Television Commission, the regulatory body for commercial television, admitted it is a difficult franchise to let, but not in our view an impossible one. It would be wrong to give the impression that we are offering a franchise that can't work. All the same, he left open the possibility that no bidder would meet the ITC's requirements, in which case no license will be granted. If Channel 5 goes ahead, it will have to begin broadcasting on the 1st of January 1995, covering at least 30% of the population, achieving full coverage of 74% from 33 transmission stations by the year 2001. The service may also be delivered by satellite. The closing date is 7th of July, when the applications will be published. Among interested parties are Silvio Berlusconi, the Italian media magnate, Phil Redmond, creator of Brookside and an unsuccessful bidder for Granada's Channel 3 franchise, and Conrad Black, proprietor of the Daily Telegraph. The biggest and costliest headache is going to be the mass video retuning in some of the areas covered by the channel's transmitters. Along with the formal invitation to apply, the ITC has issued a 12-page code of practice solely devoted to this problem. The frequency on which half the country will receive Channel 5 is Channel 37, and about one-fifth of the nation's video cassette recorders are tuned to this channel. Within the transmission areas, these VCRs will suffer heavy interference from Channel 5 signals, even in households that do not erect the new aerial needed to receive programs. These VCRs will have to be retuned to a new channel, a tricky operation that has to be carried out by an expert. All bids from potential operators of Channel 5 will have to include detailed proposals and costings for this mass retuning. It has to be carried out free within 21 days of any request in the first 3 months of operation in the relevant area. The franchise holder will be obliged to provide programs catering to a variety of tastes, and Channel 5 seems likely to compete strongly with ITV's Channel 3 in the areas where it can be received. The rules for the provision of serious programs are less stringent than those for Channel 3, partly to compensate for the retuning problem. The initial weekly minima are news, 2.5 hours, half of it must be in peak time, current affairs, 1 hour, children's programmes, 3.5 hours, and religion, 1 hour. These requirements will increase after 5 years. Michael Leitman there, writing in The Independent.
I don't see how those tuning requirements can make the thing commercially viable, even in a buoyant economy, particularly not at the moment. Anyway, Europe pushes up to set up DAB service. Perhaps some better news by Simon Lowe, writing in Electronics World News. European efforts are mounting to launch the first digital audio broadcasting services within the next 4 years. DAB's growing momentum is being partly driven by the belief that next-generation digital radio could become a huge market much earlier than high-definition television. Proponents of expediting Europe's DAB efforts cite the relative ease with which transmitter networks and radio station studios could be converted to handle DAB. Many stations are now using compact discs and other digital audio systems in the studio. DAB backers contend that only a few other studio systems would have to be added, such as digital converters for the voices of announcers. Building up a high-definition television broadcast infrastructure would be more complex, according to a broadcast official attending a DAB meeting in London last month. In addition to changes in broadcast equipment, TV stations would have to replace cameras, videotape systems and other studio equipment. The TV broadcasters also face the mammoth task of converting vast libraries of recorded programmings and movies from analogue to digital format. DAB will be the most important development in broadcasting during the 1990s, said Philip Laven, Chief Engineer for Research and Development at the BBC. Despite massive investments in and growing attention on HDTV, Laven is convinced that DAB will be more successful because it is well matched to the public needs, while offering significant benefits to broadcasters, the electronics industry, and spectrum managers. Laven added that DAB offers excellent reception, even with a simple aerial. It offers easy and convenient selection of multiple radio services, and audio quality comparable with that of compact discs. However, a number of conditions are necessary before DAB can live up to its potential, cautioned George Plenge, head of sound engineering in the radio and television division of Germany's Institute for Radio Engineering in Munich. Simultaneous introduction of DAB services across Europe in parallel with existing audio services will be needed, he said. Across Europe, broadcasters are looking for frequencies to transmit DAB in the VHF spectrum, which currently is used for television. The European industry is focusing on terrestrial broadcasts of DAB because a 1.5 GHz frequency for satellite-based services will not become available until 2007, as agreed upon at the recent World Administrative Radio Conference in Spain. Most of the technical aspects of a DAB system have now been developed by a pan-European Eureka project set up by radio broadcasters and equipment makers. The group is now investigating the possible implementation of the first DAB system. The European Broadcasting Union has listed all the possibilities, and we have a good hope for the introduction around 1995, Plenge said. There will be one channel available. The hope is to use channel 12, the top of the third band in the VHF spectrum, which is not widely used for TV in Europe. This 7 MHz TV channel could accommodate the simultaneous transmission of 4 DAB services. More DAB services might eventually be packed into the channel with compression techniques. One key advantage of DAB over existing analog radio is the system's immunity to multipath interference, which can be caused by time delay of signals. Because of the immunity, a vast network of DAB transmitters could be set up across a region or an entire country to broadcast programs at the same frequency. Today, transmitters broadcasting the same programs use different frequencies to avoid multipath interference. Radio manufacturers believe they can make DAB receivers easier to use than existing radio. Receivers could be given the capability to quickly scan the airwaves and automatically list what DAB services are available to the listener. In January, a new effort to define integrated circuits for DAB radio receivers was launched by the joint European Submicron Silicon Initiative, called JESSI. The initial phase of the program will develop specifications for the best way to implement a receiver. The program, which includes SGS Thomson, Telefunken, Grundig, Thomson and Philips, expects the main circuitry for a receiver on a two-chip set. The four-year project aims to develop ICs in time for the launch of DAB, and then reduce the number of chips as fine geometry processes become available. Well, I can't wait for that. That's DAB in Europe by 1995, they predict.
Philips DC 777 car radio is a must for all serious shortwave listeners who spend time in the car. The Philips DC 777 packs a sophisticated shortwave tuner, AM-FM tuner and cassette player and powerful stereo amplifier into a standard size car radio unit. AM, FM and shortwave coverage from 3170 to 21910 continuous. The stereo cassette deck is also auto-reverse. Check out the review in the World Radio and TV Handbook and it received 4 stars in the Radio Netherlands receiver shopping list. This top-of-the-range Philips car combination is available to Radiofax listeners at the special price of £249. Contact the Radiofax sales office by telephone in the UK on 0483 275 997 or write for the brochure at Radiofax, The Forge, Cranley, GU67BG in England.
On the Start the Week programme, Melvin Bragg talked to radio critic Gillian Reynolds about the future of BBC Radio. Here's part of their conversation.
All I'm trying to get away from is the idea that it is blanket pop at the moment. The fact is that there's a great deal of varied radio in this country. The fact that there's a great deal of what a lot of people think is...
There's not a great deal of varied radio.
Compared to all these things are relative. Compared with the USA, compared with Germany, compared with Italy, there's a great deal of varied radio. Compared with what God would want us to have, I agree with
you. Do me a favour, darling Melvin, go home and tune along your radio station bands. And
I only listen to 2 stations. It doesn't work on the other two.
Evidently. I mean, I don't want to be over-pessimistic. What is here...
You're not making a bad shot of it.
What is here at the moment is terrific, and we ought to fight to hang on to it. The thing is that there are certain kinds of radio that only the BBC can and will do, because the others just aren't commercially feasible. It would not be commercially feasible to have a Radio 3 or 4, or even a Radio 5, to do a network that was education and sport solely. You couldn't actually make a commercial return on that. So the BBC has these inheritances. And I'm very keen, just as I'm keen to hang on to good dinosaur exhibitions, to have them still there on the air. What worries me slightly is that politicians bear down and say, but who's listening?
Later, they talked about the new man responsible for national heritage and broadcasting in particular.
David Mellor may not take that as a serious enough argument for saving
I have faith in David Mellor. I mean, he's a serious chap. He listened to serious arguments about the future commercial television, and he listened to serious arguments. What we must safeguard is the fact that we have terrific services now. Further diminution is really not in anyone's interest. And I think we have to hang on to and fight for. People forget that radio listeners are ferociously loyal. They love what they hear, and there are, as Melvin quite rightly says, millions and millions of people who love it.
Just getting one point established at a time. Radio audiences have stopped dropping off for talk channels for Radio 4.
Well, for Radio 4.
All right, and started going up a bit.
LBC has had ferocious trouble in London. This is a London commercial service which has been in existence for 18 years. Had its ups, had its downs, and in the last couple of years has had considerable downs. They split their AM from their FM service. They made one or two fundamental mistakes. And suffered a huge and significant decline in audience, and only just now beginning to build it back. Radio is a tricky thing. You've got to carry with you the audience that has always liked what is there. You've got to introduce change slowly, but with confidence. You and I will remember a time in Radio 4's history when there was instant change, a lot of junctions changed, the time of the Archers changed, there were jingles. Another controller came in and, with a steady and female hand, reintroduced cautious change, abstracted the jingles, made it more like we know and love. You've got to feel, if you're a radio listener, if you're a television viewer, that it belongs to you, that it's there for you. But in any reality, whether it's public service or commercial, it's got to belong to an awful lot of other people too.
Mark Lawson.
But the comparison that's less encouraging to the BBC, particularly in terms of what's going to happen, is Radio 1, isn't it? Because you've said the problems LBC had. But if you look at something like Capital Radio, I mean, the old BBC belief, I mean, given obviously they had a limited number of channels, but their idea was that people who stopped listening to Radio 1 would move across to 2 or even 4. And in fact, what's happened is that the old Radio 1 disc jockeys set up on Capitol Gold play all the old records, and everyone goes and listens to them instead. And that's, Radio 1 is the one that, obviously, a lot of the argument is going to be over, because it has very few supporters anywhere in terms of remaining part of the BBC, hasn't it?
I'm certainly a supporter of Radio 1, because it does things that other radio stations can't do. And if Radio 1... I'm sure they do know it, but it has an awful lot of supporters in the music world, and I mean in the commercial recording world, because Radio 1 is the only network in Europe now which introduces significant numbers of new artists. All commercial broadcasting is based on the theory of familiarity.
Gillian Reynolds, Melvin Bragg and Mark Lawson on Start the Week.
Here's a surprise. Young people have positive image of engineers. In Electronics Weekly, engineers travel the world, earn lots of money, and are like doctors, lawyers, and accountants, according to young people questioned by the Engineering Council. A survey carried out to discover the impact of the council's Neighbourhood Engineers scheme revealed that the image of the engineering profession is a high-flying one. The findings reversed the widely held belief that engineers are regarded as spanner-wielding, oily individuals. The council claims the improved image has led to a substantial jump in applications to study engineering. Universities have received 80,000 applications for engineering courses, 7% higher than last year, and polytechnics have seen a 20% jump to 50,000 engineering applications. The NES scheme is backed by the DTI. Under it, engineers and technicians visit schools and give talks and demonstrations about their work. They also help with the national curriculum. Some good news. Pity it wasn't quite like that in reality, however, in Electronics Weekly.
In Hardware Magazine, a look at AutoCue prompting systems 40 years on by Mick Gould. Today, most people involved in the broadcast industry are aware of on-camera prompting systems, and their use is now accepted worldwide as an essential aid for good presentation and program making. AutoCue's range of high-brightness, high-contrast on-camera units will fit onto both large and small cameras and vary in size from the 25-inch for studio use to the revolutionary ultra-lightweight electroluminescent 9-inch flat panel display for location work. Complementing the prompting products is Newsmaker, which can be networked to the prompting systems to make up a totally integrated multi-terminal electronic production office or newsroom. To reach this level of sophistication has taken nearly 40 years. So where did it all begin? Probably the first prompter to be used in the UK was on the BBC Sportsview programme in the early 1950s. It was nicknamed the Mangle by the presenters on the programme, and from the artist's impression, its name seems to fit its appearance. The Mangle used a mirror and a piece of semi-reflective glass to focus the image of a moving script over the lens of the camera directly into the presenter's eyeline. Nearly 40 years on, this technique is still the basis of the modern-day on-camera over-the-lens prompter. In 1955, AutoCue Limited patented an electric paper roller prompter which used a mirror and a piece of semi-reflective glass to focus the image of the moving script over the lens of the camera into the presenter's eyeline. This unit was designed to attach onto the camera with special mounting brackets so that it could track and pan with the camera. Different mounting brackets and attachments were used to fit any make of camera or lens size. An operator using an electric master paper roller with an identical roll of script controlled the movement of the roll of paper to the speed of the presenter's delivery. By the use of magnetic synchronized motors, the paper roller on camera unit kept in sync with the master paper roll, or that was the theory. The master unit had the capability of running up to 4 or 5 paper roller on-camera units simultaneously. They would very rarely all run in sync, and since most programs were live in those days, the job of an AutoCue operator must have been a nightmare. The scripts were typed onto the paper rolls using a typewriter with 2-inch letters. Script changes were mostly done by hand and had to be repeated on all the paper rollers. A small change could take the operator up to 2 minutes walking round the studio, changing all the on-camera units. I've never understood why the autocue operator is so rarely listed in the credits at the end of a programme. The early 1970s saw the introduction of autocue's closed-circuit range of prompters, which at last took prompting out of the dark ages. Scripts were typed onto a small roll of paper using a normal typeface, which was fed under a closed-circuit camera at the speed of the presenter's delivery. The on-camera unit design consisted of a monitor mounted beneath the camera lens with the words reversed, which were reflected by the transparent glass over the camera lens the right way round into the presenter's eyeline. These early monitor-based on-camera units were the forerunner of the on-camera units still in use today. The on-camera units received the picture of the closed-circuit camera via a video cable from the distribution amplifier in master control. With the use of only one small paper roll script, changes only had to be made once. Scripts could be of unlimited length, and with the advances in CRT technology, the image for the presenter became brighter and clearer to read. Presenters were given the option of reversed video image, white lettering on a black background, and various font styles with the advent of the golf ball and daisy wheel typewriters. Refinements to the early on-camera monitor prompters continued throughout the 1970s to cut down the weight and to allow the television camera more tilt. During the 1980s, the computer prompter came of age. AutoCue, in conjunction with their sister company QTV in America, made the sensible decision to write their prompting software on the MS-DOS operating system and therefore be IBM compatible. This has paid dividends, as the software will run in any IBM-compatible PC. Therefore, costs are kept to a minimum, because a proprietary machine is not needed to run the software, and customers have confidence in standard PC hardware. The computer prompting software, which has been developed since the mid-80s, has benefited both the presenter and operator. Presenters now have a clear, bright and sharp computerized image with a choice of reverse video in 10 font sizes, which can be changed instantly. Readability has been greatly enhanced. There is also a choice of colors if color reading monitors are being used. The powerful word processor displays in prompt format all script changes instantly to the presenter, and by the use of markers or word search, any part of the script can be accessed in less than a second. The prompting software will operate in CGA, EGA and VGA PC compatibles, and smooth scrolling is via hand or foot control, either using the serial or games port. MS-DOS supports most foreign languages, so the prompting software is available in Cyrillic, Arabic, Greek, and all European languages. Script creation is either via the keyboard or direct import from WordPerfect 5 upwards, ASCII files generated from leading word processors via modem, or serial download from host systems. A look at AutoCue Techniques for Television Presentation by Mick Gould in Hardware Magazine.
In Electronics World News, an optically active chemical from bacteria has been used by researchers at Fuji in Kanagawa, Japan, to build an artificial retina. The researchers have demonstrated a 64-pixel image sensor using a photoactive layer of bacteriodiopsin. The chip responds only to changes in light intensity, an image pre-processing function also found in the retina. It's a pigmentation protein found in certain bacteria and has attracted research interest because it's similar to photoactive components of the retina. The Fuji researchers deposited a film over an 8x8 array of indium tin oxide electrodes, wired to an array of LEDs. Images of letters were focused on the film, and the researchers found a differential response similar to the motion detection ability of the eye. That function is an essential feature of the eye, allowing it to extract movement as well as detect essential image components such as lines and edges. A fascinating piece of research there going on in Japan. You're listening to Sparks on Radio Fax. And here's a letter from David Childs, who's in Highfield in Southampton. I've been listening to Radio Fax for only a few days. I read an article in this month's issue of Shortwave magazine about pirate radio stations, so I tried to receive a few. From the stations I received, Radio Fax was the best. I enjoy listening to your programmes and talking about radio. And he goes on to say, I listen on a low HF 225 communications receiver with a simple 10-meter dipole. I heard a letter read out this morning saying he would like more about Radio Fax. Did you say it was 50 pence? Yes, that's right, you enclosed the right amount. That's only if you'd like a reply. You don't have to send any money if you'd like your name and your letter read out on air. And here's Ken Horton, who's from Chipping Norton in Oxfordshire. I tuned into your station for the first time today. Listen to Sparks. Really enjoyed the piece about Radio Caroline. I'm listening on a Selina B215 portable radio, which is connected to an FM outside aerial. Being the highest point in Oxfordshire really helps. Thanks, Ken, listening in Oxfordshire. And Mr. A. Robinson is in Crook, County Durham. Just a few lines to let you know I'm receiving your broadcasts on the 49-metre band, clear and distinct, on a shortwave receiver, SciShow. That's the same one as I use, I think. And he listens on 6205. Thanks to Mr. Robinson. And the next letter being read out could be yours. Say what you think of the programmes and something about where you live and what you do. And if you'd like to send in your reviews of things or interesting articles you've seen or what you've been hearing around the bands, AM, FM, medium wave, etc., pirates and so on, write in your reports to Sparks, Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU6 7BG. And if you'd like a reply, as I said, 50 pence please, or 3 international reply coupons, or $1. It's Sparks, Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU6 7BG. Get writing.
We're going to dance and have some fun.
Thank you.
This week on Sparks, a review of a new guide for Sony ICF 2001D users, DAB, digital audio broadcasting developments in Britain, expensive tuning problems for Channel 5 television, radio with a difference, wireless data links, that is, a story of the Titanic, in a moment, a history of AutoCue, and your letters and a few other items in this week's Sparks.
In the Financial Times, Alexander Garrett writes about the Titanic's tales of terror. In the afternoon of April the 15th, 1912, Bruce Ismay, managing director of the White Star Line, filled out a Marconi telegram form for company headquarters in New York. Deeply regret to advise you, Titanic sank this morning 15th after collision iceberg, resulting serious loss of life. Further particulars later. Ismay was aboard the rescue ship Carpathia, one of 705 survivors. 1,516 perished. But his message remained unsent until 5:50 a.m. on the 17th, nearly 2 days later. The wireless telegraph was Carpathia's only contact with the world. And as its operator worked round the clock to send out messages from survivors, the signal from the White Star managing director, confirming what the world already feared, was overlooked. Today, a vessel involved in a collision would be in contact with Coast Guard authorities within seconds. Then, the delay caused enormous uncertainty, provoked accusations of censorship, and added one more mystery to the intrigue surrounding the disaster. His telegram is one of 448 radio signal messages relating to the Titanic disaster from 80 years ago. That the signals survived is remarkable. At the time the Titanic went down, telegraph companies kept originals of all transmitted signals for 12 months. Messages from ships involved in the Titanic disaster were assembled for the two public inquiries, one in the US, the other in London. After that, they were returned to the Marconi Company, where they were held in a vault until the late 1940s. When Cable and Wireless took over the Eastern Telegraph Company, as it had then become, the signals were earmarked for destruction, but they were salvaged by an unnamed employee, whose son found them hidden in a suitcase when his father died 30 years later. Before the wireless was invented by Marconi in 1896, ships communicated with each other by flags and light signals. But when the Titanic set sail from Southampton on Wednesday, April the 10th, 1912, she had the most powerful wireless yet fitted. She was one of the first liners to have two wireless operators, John Phillips and Harold Bride, both employed by Marconi, who could together provide a round-the-clock radio watch. Early in the voyage, they were busy telegraphing arrangements for passengers to meet relatives in New York. It was a lucrative business for Marconi. Each message cost 30 shillings, at a time when the second wireless operator earned 50 shillings a month. It is the tone of optimism that is striking. One starts, "Fine voyage, fine ship, feeling fine." Another, "Hardly wait to get back. Cable made me awfully happy. Love, Mutsy." One, however, was more ominous. Westbound steamers report bergs, growlers and field ice in 42 north from 49 to 51 west, April the 12th. On April the 12th, the Terrain radioed to report dense fog and thick ice fields. Further danger signals followed from the Californian and the Caronia. One of the great unsolved questions of the disaster is why the Titanic's captain continued to sail towards the danger zone at 22 knots, especially as Harold Bride, the Titanic's surviving wireless operator, told the US inquiry that he had passed on the message from the Californian, and it had been personally acknowledged by Captain Smith. Later that day, a fateful message was sent, "Sinking, wants immediate assistance." The shortcomings of the wireless, as then operated, became evident immediately following the collision with the iceberg. Unlike the Titanic, most of the ships that night had only one radio man, if any. Thomas Cottam, sole operator on the Carpathia, should have finished duty at midnight. At 12:30, he was about to retire when the first distress signal came through. The Carpathia sailed to the Titanic's aid at full speed, but it was 60 miles away, 3.5 hours sailing. Another ship, the Californian, was, by its own controversial account, only 19 miles away, but its wireless operator, Cyril Evans, had gone to bed. A third vessel, the Norwegian trawler Samson, may have been even closer, but had no radio. Marconi was later asked why his apparatus did not have a bell to wake the operator. He replied, "On the old equipment used by ships, there was a bell arrangement which did not work well because it alarmed the operators of all ships, as well as the one called." Titanic struck iceberg, sunk Monday 3 a.m. Carpathia picked up many passengers and preceding New York, Captain Rostron. The signals flying through the airwaves created total confusion for the press. In New York, the Evening Sun trumpeted, "All saved from Titanic after collision." The following morning in London, the account in the Times was riddled with contradiction. After reporting that the Titanic had sunk with great loss of life, it cited later that she was being towed by the Virginian to Halifax, or was heading under her own steam to New York. By the following day, April the 17th, the full extent of the tragedy had become clear, and the recriminations began. The Times scolded the Central News Agency over a phantom wireless message which had reported everybody safe, while questions were asked about signals being interfered with by amateur operators. An explanation for one of the phantom signals later materialized. A radio ham unwittingly merged two signals, one asking, "Are all Titanic passengers safe?" and another from the Aeschen announcing she was towing the German tanker Deutschland to Halifax. The result, Titanic passengers safe being towed to Halifax. Before the Titanic went down, its two radio operators were given permission to leave their posts. Bride was washed overboard, but was picked up by the Carpathia. As the Carpathia headed back to New York, he assisted Cottam in sending messages from survivors. A few remained cheerful, as, "Meet me dock with $200, underwear, cap, big cope, coat, am well, but feet slightly frozen." Others were tragic. "Mother, girls safe, father, Charlie, missing. Father not seen, no hope. Arrive Carpathia Wednesday, New York." The US inquiry made a number of recommendations about the use of radio telegraphy on ships. But although the Titanic sinking had highlighted its shortcomings, the momentous significance of radio communication for seagoing vessels was elegiacally summed up in a Times editorial on April the 16th. "But for wireless telegraphy, the disaster might have assumed proportions which at present we cannot measure, and we should have known nothing of its occurrence for an indefinite period. The advantages conferred by this abridgment of space are enormous. No vessel need be alone. None need vanish without a sign from human ken, and in none but crushing and instant disasters need any despair of help." Quote from the Times editorial at the time, 80 years ago, Alexander Garrett writing in the Financial Times about the Titanic disaster. And strangely not mentioned in that article, there is an exhibition of Signals of Disaster, the Titanic story. A terrible disaster is seen through the eyes of passengers and crew, which is an exhibition of various telegram signals from the Titanic, which can be seen as part of the Deep Sea Adventure at the Old Harbour in Weymouth in Dorset. That's open daily 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. or 10 a.m. to 10 p.m. in the high summer season.
Britain's cable operators are seeing spiralling demand for their telephone services, and up to 250,000 subscribers could be phoning through cable this time next year. In the last 3 months, 10,000 new subscribers took up cable telephone services, raising the total to almost 31,000. Alan Hindley, head of telecoms at Windsor Cable, expects demand to increase further. By this time next year, there could be over 250,000 subscribers, he said. Mercury Communications is benefiting from the success of the cable companies. Earlier this month, it reported that 3,000 residential customers are being signed up every month through its partnership with the cable operators. There are now 32,000 business and residential cable telephone lines connected to Mercury's trunk network. Telephone services are available in 15 of the UK's 50 cable franchises, and these are dominated by North American cable and telephone operators. So, an interesting letter we've had from the new Department of National Heritage. Dunno. On Home Office headed notepaper, strangely enough, signalling how quickly all these changes have come into force. So, Department of National Heritage, care of the Home Office, etc. Dear Mr. Brook, thank you for your letter of the 15th of January to Mr. Lloyd, the then Parliamentary Under Secretary of State at the Home Office with responsibility for broadcasting policy. I'm extremely sorry that you've not yet had a reply to your letter from the Home Office. I understand that the Chief Executive of the Radio Communications Agency wrote to you on the 6th of February, explaining that the Home Office would be replying. The delay is due to an oversight. Your proposal raises a number of complex issues which go well beyond the responsibilities of the Broadcasting Department, now part of the Department of National Heritage, and which we have been considering. However, it is unlikely that authorisation could be given in the short term to the kind of service that you have in mind. From Claire Craig of T1 Division of the new Department of National Heritage. Well, that's a positive letter, I suppose. It's certainly not such a negative letter.
To tell me.
is a report in the American Electronic Design magazine into wireless data communication networks by Milt Leonard. Vendors and regulatory bodies confront limited bandwidth and interference problems. Wireless networks for data communication systems continue to establish themselves as alternative solutions to problems posed by hardwired networks. Twisted pair, coaxial, and fiber optic cabling within a building environment are difficult and expensive to install, maintain, and change. Labor and material costs for wiring can reach $1,000 per node just for copper wire. Coax and optical fiber costs are considerably higher. The news gets worse when nodes are added or relocated. Studies by NCR showed that over one half of office workers with personal computers move annually. Other studies find that data terminals move as often as 1.5 to 3 times a year, with an estimated cost of $200 to $1,000 per wiring change. Plus, there's the loss of productivity due to downtime for recabling and resolving problems such as crosstalk, impedance matching, signal degradation, and data security. Given the expense and performance limitations of hardwired networking for in-building applications, the concept of using electromagnetic energy to transmit data becomes an attractive alternative. Some observers believe portable computers are an independent driving force, with the potential of dominating wireless applications. However, wireless data transfer has its own limitations. Data rates are generally slower than wire-based networks, and the number of connected nodes and their separation distance are limited. Moreover, some wireless techniques are limited to line-of-sight communication, and initial installation costs for desktop computers may be higher than cable due to the electronics needed for the communications. Perhaps the biggest concerns among advocates of radio-based wireless LANs are issues of frequency allocation by the Federal Communications Commission and the lack of standards for wireless technology. Both factors will influence the design of supporting hardware and software and the degree of interoperability for wireless products. Bob Zavril, Product Marketing Manager for RF Personal Communications at GEC Plessy Semiconductors in California, says the lack of regulatory guidelines has created camps of zealous advocates who are lobbying for standard bandwidths that favour their technology base. The regulatory environment is beset by a confusion of political, technological, and commercial interests, says Zavril. Wireless networks presently link computers through infrared light or radio waves. Where infrared data transmission is a matured technology with well-defined advantages, limitations and application areas, radio-based LAN technology is somewhat fuzzy round the edges. At present, two radio-based approaches are vying for dominance: spread spectrum and narrow band. Spread spectrum radio transmission uses complex circuitry to fragment data signals over a wide band of frequencies for increased immunity from interference and eavesdropping. Spread spectrum data transmission originated in military communication systems that required high immunity to electromagnetic noise, jamming, multipath signal distortion, and eavesdropping, while preserving high data transmission integrity. For wireless LANs, it offers full compatibility with multiple access, multiple user requirements, and it also has the potential for wider bandwidths than what's available. A spread spectrum system distributes transmitted data over a range of carrier frequencies that's much wider than the minimum transmission bandwidth. A baseband signal of only a few kilohertz is obscured or hidden within a frequency band that's many megahertz wide. At the receiver, the signal is remapped into the original information bandwidth. The result is error-free data transmission in the presence of noise. The most popular spread spectrum modulation schemes are direct sequence frequency hopping and pulsed chirp. Direct sequence modulation uses a code sequence to phase modulate the carrier across a continuous band of frequencies. Unlike direct sequence spread spectrum techniques, carrier frequency shifting or frequency hopping shifts the data modulated carrier frequency across a spectrum of multiple discrete frequencies in a pattern determined by a code sequence. Pulsed frequency or chirp modulation sweeps the carrier across a wide frequency band during a pulse interval and is used mostly in radar. For wireless LANs, direct sequence modulation is commonly used. In this, the carrier frequency is modulated by a pseudo-random noise source and the coded data to be transmitted. Total bandwidth increases as the rate of these two signals increases, and immunity from interference increases with bandwidth. Secure communications is inherent because the receiver, local oscillator, and transmitter output signal must be synchronized by some predetermined code that modulates the data stream. Baseband data is usually digitized and added to the PRN code sequence. The composite signal is then mixed with the carrier oscillator signal in a balanced modulator, amplified and mixed at the receiver with a reference that has the same code. The receiver next restores the baseband signal, which is sent through a filter that passes only the baseband modulated carrier. Direct sequence modulation requires simple circuitry and has good performance. Also, using code division multiplexing lets multiple users employ different codes to operate simultaneously on the same frequency by applying identical single carrier transceivers. In contrast, narrowband radio employs simpler implementations to transport data in 10 MHz channels within a higher frequency band, microwave. A narrowband data link is established by tuning the transmitter and receiver to the same frequency. The FCC now permits low-power in-building radio communication in 10 MHz channels within the 18 to 19 GHz digital termination services band. This frequency band lies between the lower spread spectrum and the higher infrared frequencies. Using the 10 MHz channels requires FCC licensing. As with infrared LANs, narrowband LANs are implemented in various ways for different applications. One example is the Altair line from Motorola, which is an offshoot from the company's wireless in-building network technology introduced in 1990. The product line consists of a ceiling-mounted control module that hooks up to a server or Ethernet backbone, and desktop user modules that connect up to 6 devices each. Control and user modules automatically adjust to the appropriate frequencies. Although line of sight isn't required, the signal will be blocked by concrete or steel. User data rate is specified at 3.3 megabits per second, and the 25 milliwatt power output produces a range of 130 feet. Motorola says the low propagation rate of 18 GHz signals allows portions of the spectrum to be reused without interference. For security, the data encrypts data prior to transmission. NCR's WaveLAN consists of a circuit board cabled to an omnidirectional antenna and mounted near the housing for location near a PC. Capable of up to 2 megabits per second data transmission rates, the spread spectrum system doesn't need an FCC license and supports any number of PCs located within 1,000 feet. The use of a directional antenna increases operating range to 5 miles. Moreover, the system allows individual wireless nodes to be connected to a hardwired backbone. In a typical office environment, one PC used as a file server can be equipped with both a WaveLAN module and a backbone connection. WaveLAN uses the Ethernet Carrier Sense Multiple Access with Collision Avoidance protocol to handle data collisions. A novel spread spectrum system innovated by Proxim in California also comprises a circuit board with an attached antenna. When plugged into a full-size PC slot, the antenna extends from the backplane. Range LAN has a range of up to 800 feet and a data rate of 242 kilobits per second. Proxim's patented technology divides the available 902 to 928 MHz bandwidth into three subchannels for additional noise immunity. This can occur when the user selects the most noise-free channel. The band partitioning also effectively triples available bandwidth when used concurrently, says Paul Smith, Vice President of Marketing at Proxim. The product also has a patented post-correlation circuit for signal capture that contributes to low cost, low power, and small size. The relative merits and weaknesses of narrowband and spread spectrum technologies provoke considerable debate. Advocates of narrowband technology point out the data rate limitations of spread spectrum systems operating within 900 MHz band. The argument continues that present FCC bandwidth allocation for spread spectrum communications can't support more than about 2 megabits per second data rates, which is only a fifth of the preferred 10 megabits per second data rate for communications. Narrowband supporters concede that RF energy in the UHF environment can propagate through and around obstacles for reception from distant sources. But this same property limits spectrum reuse, which they say is a necessity for optimum capacity in a wireless LAN. For these reasons, narrowband people see spread spectrum technology being stuck in limited applications. Conversely, the argument goes, 18 GHz signals used by narrowband systems are ideal for in-building use because signal reflection and diffusion can fill a microcellular area using a minimum amount of power. The same frequencies can be reused by other neighbouring systems. Moreover, the 18 GHz band is high enough to avoid interference to or by other electrical equipment. Still, many industry observers expect spread spectrum technology to thrive in the wireless LAN arena because of two reasons: its inherently high immunity to interference and forthcoming new frequency allocations from the FCC. Stanford Telecom has also established a base of high-frequency building blocks for telecommunications, primarily for spread spectrum systems. These ASICs include modulators and demodulators, pseudo-noise coders, and forward error correction circuits. A recent design produced a three-piece spread spectrum demodulator chipset that reduced the parts count of a prior design by half. The entire design is expected to shrink to a single IC by the middle of this year. A report in Electronics Design magazine about the latest in local area networks for computers.
You can twist and turn.
From Mr. J. Southern, who's in Worthing in West Sussex, having tuned into your station many times since starting this recent hobby of shortwave listening, I've finally bucked up enough courage to write into you. I hope we're not that scary. When I first listened to you all those years ago, back in February, March 92, I came across Sparks, and I listened and taped all the brilliant tips and news that you gave. However, when I tried to identify you in the World Radio TV Handbook, 92 edition, I couldn't see Radio Facts listed. It wasn't until I joined the British DX Club and the World DX Club that I saw you listed under the pirate, or rather unlicensed section, that I realised the awful truth. Firstly, how come? Your station is of a great quality and it provides a wide diversity of programmes to keep everyone interested, and by far beats some of the more well-known licensed international broadcasters. Is there anything we, the listeners, can do? Well, yes, bars of gold are greatly appreciated, so we can keep it going, in case you find any of them. Anyway, my favourite programme is Sparks, and I love the music also. I tune in on 6205 during the day and 3910 at night. My receiver is a modest Philips D2935 with a 30 metre long wire from the attic to the garden, north to south, fed via a DCOM ATU, and most days I receive you fairly clearly. That's Mr. J. Southern, who's in Worthing in West Sussex, and both 6205 and 3910 he reports to be good signals. And hello to Chris Roper, who's in County Londonderry, a town called Cross. I must just start by saying that I wouldn't normally listen to an HF radio station as such, because I'm interested in the airband side of radio. However, after seeing an article in Shortwave magazine, when Shannick or whatever is quiet, I flip over to 6205 for a listen to you. I'm afraid the equipment I've got is basic, a Sangyan ATS-803 with 9 metres of wire up in the roof space. And reception is not what it could be, although respectable. Anyway, could you please send me programming and transmission time so I can make full use of the services you're offering? I also have a friend who's interested, but too lazy to write, tut tut. So I hope a pound enclosed will cover two lots of information. I'm not into the technicalities of radio at all, too long in the tooth to absorb it all, but I feel sure I could get more from this set with an improved antenna. But cheap, as my disposable income is almost nil. Right, that will do for now. Many thanks, and keep up the good work. That's Chris Roper listening in County Londonderry in the Republic of Ireland. Now, Sparks is approaching a year old, believe it or not. I certainly wouldn't have believed I'd still be here in a year's time when I started doing the programmes, but I should have had more faith. So, as we're approaching a year old, it's time for another competition. And the question this time, for all eager loggers, get the logbooks out, is what was the first date this last year. Not going to fall for that one this time. What was the first date last year that Sparks was heard on Radio Fax? It's not a trick question. We've only been on Radio Fax. So what was the first date that Sparks was heard in 1991? Programme number one. What was the date? And the prize, there's four of them up for grabs. Each a copy of a New Scientist poster of the history of computing, which is a large fold-out cartoon poster describing, funnily enough, the history of computing. And that can be yours if you write in and answer that question. And if you don't know the answer, we'll have a guess. It's obviously just coming up to a year's time. So, an intelligent guess, and you never know, you might win. Four copies of New Scientist's History of Computing poster to be won. And send in to Sparks, Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU6, 7BG. And if you'd like a reply, please send 50 pence, three international reply coupons, or $1. But you don't need to send that if you just want to enter the competition. So, the address again, Sparks, Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU6, 7BG. All letters and comments are always welcome. And if you fancy writing to your MP, moaning that shortwave independent broadcasting isn't licensable in this country, then you'd be more than welcome to. And send us a copy of the letter you send and the reply you get, and we'll read them out. So, let's have another letter, I think. One sitting here, eager to be read. Dave Friends, I've heard and read so much about your station, it was a real treat to clearly listen to your station last night. I have a friend who spent several weeks in Sligo, in Ireland, and he told me a lot about your station. We both would appreciate an update on your station. Are you also broadcasting on medium wave? Not this time, no. In 1988, we were on 1611, and sadly, we haven't been able to do that this time, partly because Vatican Radio were wiping us out rather horribly on 1611, and also we had to change transmitter sites, and the new one isn't really suitable for MF broadcasting, because it's not such a good ground, and it's not such a suitable position. So, no medium wave, unfortunately. Your signal is very much in the clear, and I only wish we could listen in more often. As it was today, we had unusually good conditions. I'm 37 years old and have ardently returned to shortwave listening, along with my wife and children. Dave Friends, who lives in Milwaukee in the United States. He picked us up on 6205. Well done, Dave. And he's got a Drake R8 with a long wire aerial. Well, we'd love to run more power so more Americans could pick us up, but the electricity bill is too much for us, unfortunately. That's a good report there from Dave Friends in Milwaukee. Here's some technical news from Electronics Weekly. A credit card-sized optical memory card, which could replace all existing magnetic and optical media, has been developed by a small Californian company. The Compact Card, product now in development at Urshan Research Corps, is expected to perform much like high-speed static RAM and could eventually replace floppy drives, hard drives, and RAMs. We believe it will replace the CD, the tape cassette, the DAT, and the VHS, said Shelley Weiss from Urshan. It could also possibly replace laser discs by providing master quality memory that could eventually put an entire movie on a credit card. We keep finding new applications all the time, he said. The drive will have no moving parts except for those used to seat and eject the card. Laser beams will be used to write, read and erase information by moving across the face of the device. Weiss refused to describe any technical details of the card, because the patent is still pending, but he said that physicists who have speculated on how such a device might work still haven't figured out the technology. Firms such as Apple and Tektronix have expressed interest in eventually using the technology. Well, marvellous report. Is it a wind-up, I wonder? It's probably many years into the future that it will see movies on a credit card.
I heard you on the wireless back in 52, lying awake intently tuning in on you. If I was young, it didn't stop you coming through.
Oh, oh, oh.